The following inspiring Torah class is brought to you by Nale.com.
Hello, it is good to be back with you. We're going to be learning about Tisha B'Av. So we're going to be doing two different shiurim. This one is about the destruction itself. So I want to tell you why it's almost impossible for us to really, really feel the pain of the destruction. There's a famous parable, and to grasp the parable, you have to go back to Spain at the time of the Inquisition. So imagine a family. Let's call them Diego. And they're assimilated to Spain, but they're not assimilated as Jews. They know who they are. And when the going got tough, the father of the family said, okay, we're going to go. Now, I don't know how many, if any of you who are listening, are Moroccan, Tunisian, any place from North Africa, but every one of your ancestors probably made the same decision. Now, leaving at that time wasn't like leaving today. It meant basically abandoning many of your possessions, because why should your neighbor pay for your house if he's going to get it tomorrow? It means risking a journey on the seas, and in those days there were pirates. So envision this, you're a girl of 17, your father says we're going, so you're going. The boat is taken by pirates. What's the worst thing that could happen to you? The worst thing that could happen to you is that you don't get killed. So if that happens, what will happen next? Besides the indescribable horror of what would go on between you and the sailors on the boat, you'd be sold in the slave market in Marrakesh, and somebody would buy you. And let's say a year from then, you have his child. If you were to ask to sum up your life in the last year, you would say tragedy, horror. And the child grows up in the harem. If the child at the age of 12 was asked to sum up her life, you may say her life is tragic, but she wouldn't say her life is tragic. She's in the harem. She probably is friends with the other children in the harem. She has food. She has a mom. She doesn't say her life is tragic. She'll hear what you say about her life, and she may believe you, but it doesn't feel organically tragic. So let's go forward. She's 13, 14. It's time for her to be sold out of the harem. You're tearing your hair out with grief. How could you let her face this and how powerless you are? And she sees this as the normal progression. You know, nobody stays in the children's house forever. She has a child. That child will see her life as normal. So our problem is that we see exile as normal. What's abnormal has become normal. And because of this, we have no way, no access. Historically, in her historic memory, we have no access of envisioning who we would really be without Golus. So that's the real tragedy of the Chorban. The real tragedy of the Chorban is that it robbed us of our identity. There are a lot of symptoms of this. So I'm going to give you one symptom. I teach in Neve, as many of you know, and a significant proportion of the students come here after having gone on the March of the Living. They've been to Poland, and that strengthens their Jewish identity. So to them, what brings them to Neve? Why are our people singled out? Who are we? That's a terrible way to find out who your people are. So many thousands of Jews identify themselves as victims. Who are we? We're the eternal victims. We've suffered so much. Therefore, I have to find out the mystery of why we suffer. As though victimhood is an identity, as though suffering is an identity. I remember the first time I caught on to this, that there's something wrong with this way of looking at things. I have a cousin who's not observant, who had a book, a very beautiful book of photographs by Roman Vizniak, pre-Holocaust Europe. And shortly thereafter, somebody gave me another book, also photographs, called Survival. And they were both the kind of books that, if you had to have a musical accompaniment, the music would be violin in minor note. Tragic, tragic. And I asked my cousin, do you want your book back? And he said, no. And he said it with some force, even though he's a very mild-mannered person. And I got it. It suddenly, you know, in Hebrew you say, Nafal ha'asimon. I am am not going to see who I am only because other people have persecuted me and tried to kill me. There's a self in there, and that self is what's relevant to me. That other people are threatened by that self enough to do the worst possible tortures is not relevant to me for my identity. So one cost that Gullis has exacted is that we forget who we are, we lose our identity. And what's worse, at least in my opinion, is we create a new identity, an identity defined through suffering. So I want to get back to what actually happened, the actual events of the Churban, and how they affect us. So in Churban Bayit Rishon, what happened? What went wrong? So you only have to look at the books of prophecy to get the answer to that. They didn't hold back their words. What went wrong is that before we lost our identity through exile, we destroyed and distorted our identity. Not somebody else did, we did. And that sentence implies that we have an identity. So what's our identity and how did we distort it? So the identity that we have is stated in the Torah. Hashem says, I didn't choose you because you're the most numerous of the nations. I chose you because of the patriarchs, their merit. So when you're looking at what was destroyed, we destroyed ourselves as in terms of our identity and our sacred self-knowledge before anything external was destroyed. We destroyed Avraham within us. We destroyed Yitzchak within us. We destroyed Yaakov within us. How? So the Talmud tells us that there are three major sins for which the first temple was destroyed. The first one was idol worship. So I want to tell you something about idol worship. This is going to sound self-understood, but it really isn't. You can't worship idols and worship God at the same time. Why am I telling you this at all? You know this. An idol is anything that you create, anything that is a creation by your hand or your imagination, to which you say, this has control. So there are many forces that we give control to. Okay, the medical community, and not because there's anything wrong with them, there's something wrong with our relationship to them. The political community, the financial community. Listen to how we talk. Okay. The doctor said, it's beyond help. Oh, they did? And there's no one else in this picture? You see them, you hear God's voice coming from their mouth, as though you can't have a direct relationship with them. So I want to give you an alternative picture, a different way of looking at a medical calamity. I attend the Breslov Shul in Harnof for Shacharis on Shabbos. So as things worked out, the last 2 years we haven't had a Rav. The Rav moved. So initially he came back for Shabbosos, then he stopped because his daughter moved out of the neighborhood. So the regular folks in Har Nof run the shul. We have a homegrown gabbai and a homegrown speaker. So in any case, the speaker, the one who says Rav Nachman's stories after Tikkun Klali, after the psalms that are traditionally recited by Breslov Hasidim, are said, had stomach issues. And, you know, he did all the things that one does, I'm sure. You know, rice, grated apple, all of that. And then, of course, the end of that path sometimes is to the doctor. And the doctor takes you through antibiotics and various other antibiotics. And all of this time is passing until he reached a point where he could actually feel something in his stomach, which led to a trip to the oncologist, and of course many tests. And finally the day when he's sitting in front of the oncologist with all of the tests in front and all of the scans and all of this and all of that, he said it was a 7-hour meeting between him, various other doctors, I'm sure his wife was there. The bottom line of all of the 7 hours is that they really don't have anything definable to do. There are various experimentary treatments, nothing that looks very hopeful because the cancer metastasized and is all over his body. And what was his response? So I want to tell you what an exile-oriented response would be. We're in exile because we lost ourselves. Of course, we know who we are through suffering. But we lost ourselves. We're directly connected to Hashem. But in exile, we lose it. So most people, I think, would have taken the doctor's words with at least the same seriousness that they would take, let's say, a pasuk in Chumash, maybe more. So that's the end. And go into a deep depression and acceptance. I think anger goes between the two. And that's how it would be. He decided something else. He decided, and these are the words he used, he spoke to us about this on Shabbos. He said, decided to be simple. Not simple in the sense of foolish, simple in the sense of seeing things as they are. Yes, this is what's in me. Yes, there's a growth. But you know, I could brush my teeth with simplicity and say, it's marvelous to have a toothbrush, it's marvelous to have toothpaste, it's great to brush your teeth. It's a chesed from God. And they gave him 2 weeks. Here it is a month later. He seems the same. I don't know how he feels. He seems the same. You ask him how he is. He says, Sameh u'mu'ushar, happy and content. So this past week when he spoke, he said, people ask me whether I'm afraid. And he said, you know, in the story, the famous Reb Nachman's story of the sophisticated and the simpleton, the story climaxes with the simple son, the one who's direct and clear-minded. No, he knows the king. And the sophisticated is still questioning the king's existence because he never met him directly. Now, how did either of them come to the king? Because they were summoned. That's just a fragment of the story. So he said, if the king summons me, I'll be simple. I'll go. I mean, who am I going to? Someone who hates me? Someone who's going to treat me badly? No, I'm going to the one who I've been calling for years. Avi Malki, my father, my king, the one who created me, the one who gave me the life I have, the one who gave me my wife, my children. And this is only in this world. Who am I afraid to face? So that person is not in Golus, but most of us are. So if you worship Avodah, you've lost in yourself is the Yitzchak in you. The Yitzchak in you is completely devoted to Hashem. Yitzchak took that moment of the Akedah and he was able to say, this is going to be my life. I'll give myself to Hashem, not in the great dramatic moments, but every day. He was the one who initiated the idea of spiritual self-discipline. Okay, something else we lost in our identity, besides having lost Yitzhak. We lost Avraham. How did we lose Avraham? So Avraham explored the world. He looked at the world. He saw its wonder. The textures, the tastes, the enormous intricacy. And he saw, and the Midrash tells us how, by the way, he saw the stars, those like white diamonds in the sky, and he was fascinated. But then, come morning, you don't see them. He saw the sun with its intensity, its blaze. It's the energy source. It's the source of light and warmth. This is it. Then he saw the sunsets at night. And he realized that there's a unifying force. So this unifying force is what he worshipped, and he took it a step further. He said that I'm going to bring this force into the world. I'll be living a life of kindness and justice, and through doing that, I'll bring consciousness of the source of these traits into the world. A person who's Avraham cannot be promiscuous, because all promiscuity is exploitive. If you see the world as a beautiful gift from God, and you want to be a giver, because that's what you're inspired to be, you can't possibly exploit someone. And it goes further. Yaakov was a person of truth. He could see the truth in everyone, every person he encountered. If you have Yaakov living inside of you, you can't possibly murder. So we lost our identity. So I want to tell you what that means. It means that we were in exile before we were in exile. We were already distant. And because of this, the halachot on Tisha B'Av changed midday. You would think that at midday, the halachot would be more stringent, because that's actually when the temple burned. That's when they threw in the torches. So why are we more strict in the morning and less strict in the afternoon is a reasonably good question. So I want to tell you why. Until the afternoon, when the fires began and the temple was destroyed, God had not yet determined that he would set forth his wrath against stones, against wood. We were still the target. We were still the target because we were so, so lost. So people often, when they look at the horrors of exile, because this is the root of all of the horrors, everything grows from the same tree. Why are the punishments so severe? So I want to take you back to the very first time we have Hashem sitting in judgment on humans as a group. At the end of Parashat Bereshit, it says, Hashem says, Lo yidon ruchi ba'adam b'shegam hu basar. My spirit won't resonate in man because he's only flesh. Okay, and then it goes on, it says, V'chol machshavot libo ra kol hayom. And all of the thoughts of their hearts are evil all day long. What does this mean? It means I can't be in you if you don't let me in. So what is the, I want you to focus on this phrase, the inclination of my thoughts are evil all the day. What does that mean? It means there's no conflict. Evil comes like this, it's easy. It feels right, it feels legitimate, it feels normal. When you reach the point where there's no conflict between good and evil, then good doesn't stand a chance anymore. And when that happens, the kindest thing is destruction before your hole gets even deeper. So after having said that, okay, the psukim go on, and it says that Hashem will not give us limited chances. Okay, only 120 years. So what does it mean he won't give us any more chances? That implies that there were chances given. So Rashi quotes the Gemara, and remember, Rashi's goal is to give you the simple meaning of the text, not to fool around. This is necessary to understand the text at all. There was a mini flood before the great flood. I'm sure many of you aren't aware of this. A third of the world was destroyed. That could have done the job potentially. What should that have said to the people? It should have said, I'm powerless, there's a force beyond me, I should turn to him. No, it changed nothing. It changed nothing. So in order to give them the opportunity to be defined, to have a reason to live, to have an identity as humans, God did the great flood. So let's go back to, again, the destruction itself. So it was destroyed because we were destroyed. Okay, the actual act of destruction is something also to focus upon. How did it happen? So you're familiar with some of the stories about how the Jews, at the time of the First Temple, recognized that the Babylonians were the enemy and therefore made a series of alliances with Egypt. And you could say reasonably, what's wrong with that? Nothing. There's no commandment in the Torah not to make military alliances. So what was wrong? What was wrong is that, again, they lost their identity as they did this. They were under the impression, and now it's going to be okay. Why? Because we have Egypt in our corner. That's what they thought. So this wasn't okay. This couldn't be okay. This was still another reason for them to be destroyed. So the destruction took place. It's not a coincidence that it took place on the 9th of Av. Maharal talks about the number 9. Let's say you're starting from the very beginning, the Evin Shetiya, the place where everything started, the womb of the world. Let's call it number 1. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's as far as you can go without starting a whole other number unit. So the number 9 is always used as a symbol of absolute pirud, absolute dissolution, absolute distance from unity. Avram saw a unifying force underneath everything. Okay, the Jews lost it. The only thing that did unify them was the destruction itself, which is a pattern that we've seen repeated many, many, many times. So it's going to be on the 9th of Av. Okay, the 9th of Av, the day in which there's the most separation from Hashem's compassion and presence as we could possibly feel. So this day has been set aside as a day of mourning. So here's a mistake you might make. You think terrible things happened on that day, and that's why it's a day of mourning. No. It's a day that was set aside from the time Hashem created the world to be a day of mourning. And because of that, it just so happened that these terrible events, that these horrifying events happened on this day. So I want to explain this more. In the non-Jewish world, people see time as a sort of artificial device to give structure to events. So it's easier to structure your life when you could say, I'll be there Tuesday, I'll be there Wednesday, I'll be there at 4, I'll be there at 5. They see it as artificial, like the equator. The equator isn't an actual line. It's a modem that we created to understand the world better. Okay, but that's not so. Time actually has its own force and power. And this is how Shabbos could be considered as being kadosh, even during the time that the world was new. In other words, it isn't just people kept Shabbos, and Shabbos Bereishis, it was kadosh already. The time itself was different. So this is why the holidays are called Mikra'ei Kodesh. They call out Kedusha. They inherently, again, even before there's a sukkah, that time cried out sukkah. Before there was Pesach, that time cried out liberation. Every time has a different capacity. So Tisha B'Av is a time of mourning, meaning it's a time to which all of this divisiveness that hides Hashem's unified presence from us, all of the times that we blinded ourselves, the consequences take place on Tisha B'Av. Okay, the word of, now the word of, like all of the Aramaic words that are used in the contemporary calendar, must have a meaning in Aramaic, but as you all know, in Hebrew, Av means father. So our big question is, how does a father do this to his children? Has he forgotten them? Has he abandoned them? So the answer is no. Chodesh Av is of Av Uben, that's how you spell it. It's a time of the father and the children. It's a time of binding, where Hashem's closeness to us was manifest through destruction, not as we would like it. And why destruction? Because we had lost our identity, as we said. So taking this idea further, so we have that the time itself has unique properties. And that's why later in history, so many terrible events happened on this day. So I'm sure you're familiar with most of them, but this is the day where the Inquisition edicts came forth. So what was the effect of the Inquisition edicts? There's a book I want to suggest that you read. It's in big letters, you see the word Divine Madness. In fact, it's a book by Rabbi Avigdor Miller, and it has in small letters its real agenda. It's about the Holocaust. It's an extremely, extremely well-documented book. It's a work of art. He didn't want it published in his own lifetime because the pain was so great that people couldn't hear what he was saying. What was he saying? He was saying, in short, that we lost ourselves. We destroyed ourselves before the Germans stepped in. How so? Let's move the Chorban of the Beis HaMikdash to more contemporary Chorbanot. So, Chorban Europa, the destruction of Europa. What brought that about? So when you look at it, unlike the way some people like to look romantically at pre-war Europe, the direction they were going, via the Torah, was only away from, and fast. The Haskalah, which had resided, so to speak, the Jewish Enlightenment, in Germany and in France and in England, which of course not in great numbers, because how many Jews live in France or in England? The expulsions of the medieval era got them out. But there were Jews in Germany and in Austria, and to them, this was a golden time. This is the time for change, for changing your identity. Changing your identity. It said in Frankfurt on top of the synagogue, be a Jew in your home and a human being in the street, a mensch in the street. What does that even mean? It means that a Jew is less than a mensch. A Jew isn't human. That's deep exile. Very deep exile. And once this feeling was there in the air, it spread. Just today, on the way coming to the studio, I heard the news, and I'm something of a newsie, so of course I was listening carefully. The European Union has decided that they want to take the moral high ground, and since, of course, the Palestinians should have their own state, they will not acknowledge academic degrees given by Israeli institutions over the Green Line. They will make difficulty in banking from banks that have offices over the Green Line. Where is that coming from? I don't think there's anybody who's listening to this who believes this comes from true compassion on the Palestinians, because they don't have compassion on the Arabs who are being killed every day in Syria. You don't hear a word about that. It's not coming from compassion. It's coming from hatred. It's coming to want to see us despoiled and embattled. Why? Why do they want this? So the answer is, of course, very complex. But the basic reason they want this is because this is what's right. This is what will bring us to our tikkun. They wanted it. So destruction is something that we need. How do you relate to it? So when I say the Jews in Europe wanted it, I don't mean consciously. Consciously, they didn't want it. They resisted. And people often consider them cowardly for not resisting more dramatically. And they point out how in the Warsaw Ghetto, they held out for 2 weeks when all of Poland couldn't do that. But I want to point out something else. How many survivors were there in the Warsaw Ghetto? Where would we be if everyone tried to resist? No survivors, except people who left early. So the reason I'm telling you this, when I say they wanted it, their souls wanted it. Everybody's soul wants tikkun, wants rectification, wants return. So the road was cut off by their bad choices, by their gullus, by their having abandoned the devotion of Yitzchak. And again, Berlin in the 30s, a lot of Avraham. And certainly the truth of Yaakov, which is manifest in Torah. The way they were going was only away from, and their souls demanded, no. And Hashem did for them, I didn't say to them, did for them what they needed. So anybody with a heart could ask, what is she talking about? What arrogance from somebody who never suffered? What arrogance? You hear about terrible things that happened in the destruction of the temple that were mirrored during the Holocaust. The world didn't change. You read the story of Marta Bat Baitus, how she was dragged in the street by horses till she died. You read about how they would tie people to cars and have to clue cars in two different directions, rip them apart. You hear the worst of the worst. The worst of the worst. And I'm saying people wanted it. Nobody wanted it consciously. Nobody wanted it consciously. But I want to tell you something. I'm going to tell you a story to back it up. I had a student. She came to Neve under very unusual circumstances. She and her boyfriend, who is Jewish, were traveling together. She's Lebanese. And they were doing a tour. They had traveled through Europe on bicycle. It sounds actually like a marvelous tour. They came down through, I think, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel was their route, if I'm not mistaken. Now, They were curious about Judaism, not committed in any way. And he began to study, she began to study, and at some point she realized that just because her name sounded Jewish, and just because certainly her face sounded Jewish, I mean, she looks like one of us, no one inquired carefully enough and asked, "Are you Jewish?" And she came forward and said, "You know, I'm not Jewish." So that led to a lot of stuff happening. Her husband was influenced to, her boyfriend was influenced to separate from her, at least for the time being, until they resolve who they are. Is she with him? Is she not with him? What path are they going to go? So in the middle of all of this, her father was taken gravely ill, and she had to go back to the States. And she was very enraged when she went back. She had a great deal of resentment against the religious community for having put her in this position. Okay, I never thought we would see her again. I could picture him going back there, but I could never picture her returning to Israel. To what? She did come back and she did a proper conversion. So I asked her why. So she said during her absence, she did a lot of studying. What are the Jews? So she knew their identity through suffering. She didn't know that much else. But she realized that if she was living in Europe during the Holocaust years, there are really only two choices. Either you're the one who they're shoving on the trains, or you're shoving someone on the trains. Maybe passively, maybe actively. So I would rather be one of you. This is what I mean when I said they wanted it. Under the surface, any Jew would rather be whatever the Germans are not. And we had to face this confrontation. And there's going to be an accounting, make no mistake, because the Germans certainly didn't do this because they saw themselves as divine messengers in any way. There's going to be accounting. But when you look above this, and you say, and what does the suffering take us to? You have to take it back to this destruction of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. It came from our losing our identity. We can't be ourselves if we have no self. So the alternative that people have often devised was say, I won't be myself, I'll be one of everybody else. And this is what feeds the persecutions. And this is why the persecutions of the Jews have a whole different tone than the persecutions of other peoples. So there's a lot of suffering that's taking place. And at this point, as we're getting closer to Mashiach, the suffering that we observe and experience isn't coming from one direction, it's coming from two directions. Does this have a parallel in ancient times? Did it begin then? Yes. Yes. All the way back, when Yishmael was still Avraham's son, still living at home, something happened, and he was expelled because his true nature came forth. What was this true nature? So, as you probably know from Rashi, it says that he was laughing. Nothing wrong with laughing. In fact, all good comedians are Jewish, not really, but a lot of them are. What was he laughing at? So, the Gemara tells us he was shooting arrows towards Yitzchak, who was only a baby, purposely missing him. He didn't want to kill him, but scaring him. Sarah heard that laughter. I want you to hear what she heard. She heard in that laughter idol worship. She heard murder. And she heard promiscuity. Because all of them are mockeries of what human value is. Each one of those three major sins mock what being a human is. And her conclusion was that Ishmael can't influence Yitzchak. He has to leave. So Avraham didn't contradict her. And when you look at the text carefully, you'll notice this. He doesn't say, no, it's perfectly all right. Yishmael's a fine young man. No. He didn't want to expel Yishmael because he was his son, because he believed that he could change. He's his son. Okay, so Yishmael is expelled along with Hagar, who probably is the main influence in his life. And he's dying of thirst. And he's under the tree, and Hagar abandons him to die. And then she's weeping, and an angel comes, and she discovers a spring, and she gives him water, and things seem to work out just fine. But there's one part that that people sometimes forget. The angels above ask God, how could you save him through water when the temple will be destroyed, his descendants are going to torture Jews through their thirst for water. They'll give them goat skins that people used to use to contain water like canteens, give it to people, but it really had compressed air on the inside and people would die. So Hashem's famous answer is, I'll judge Yishmael for how he is now. But I want to tell you something. Yishmael, as he is now, today, 5775, 2015, Yishmael, as he is today, deserves nothing better than the consequences of his choices. This is where we are now. There is nothing in our current Golus that isn't a reflection of the previous ones. We're suffering from the people who made a mockery of what we had abandoned, and their heartlessness and their complete disregard for anything human hasn't changed a whit, nothing. So when you talk about the terrible things that we go through today, which have their roots from then, when you talk about this, you might remember this maybe 13 years ago or so, a little bit less. The woman who lived near Gush Katif was out with her kids. An Arab murderer hijacks her car, kills her kids in front of her before killing her, and then kills her and split her belly open because she was heavily pregnant and he didn't want the fetus saved. This is somebody who mocks life. This is somebody who thinks that murder is a joke. This is what we're facing today. These are people who have no sense of truth. The sense of truth that we abandoned, Yaakov's truth, is seeing good in every person. They see good in every person. One of the worst things and most evil things I ever saw is I saw a film clip of someone from ISIS having a child behead someone. A child of maybe 12, a boy of 12. That man did not see the truth of God's presence in his victim or in the child. The child was one of them, Ki'ilu. These are people who do not have any sense of divinity or truth. Nothing. These are people who are capable of Gilei Arayot, of all sorts of promiscuity. An error that people make is they see the extraordinary modesty, the physical modesty of the Arab women, and they think that that's a reflection on Arab society, that they're modest. They are modest, there's no denying that. But there are two kinds of modesty. Defensive modesty, I better be covered because what will happen to me if I'm not? Or modesty that comes from a sense of inner dignity. I want to be modest because I'm a bat melech. The concept of bat melech does not exist in their society. They don't believe that women can go to Gan Eden. They could believe that at best they could not go to Gehenna. So we're confronted again and again with the grotesqueries that make us look at ourselves and say, and where are we? Where are we? How did we end up in this position? Let's take this further. The destruction of the first temple, which was certainly bloody enough and horrific enough, took us out to exile. So the function of exile was always confrontation. Confrontation with who you are and what you don't want to be and what you don't want to identify with, so you could finally say, wake up, ani lo ze, just like this woman who converted said, I am not the Germans. We had to at some point say, I am not the Babylonians. The Babylonians were a militant society, and everyone loves a winner. But when we observed their harshness and their cruelty, we could have come to the point of saying, I am not that. And we did to some degree. Now, a tricky aspect of exile is that it seems like home. It feels like home. Just like in the example I gave you at the beginning of the shiur, where the harem feels like home. So life was good in Babylon. Torah flourished in Babylon. Shtzura, Pampadisan, Naharda. These were great centers of scholarship. The Babylonian Talmud is what's conventionally studied today. It's much broader and more comprehensible than the Yerushalmi Talmud. So how did that happen? So the way that happened is that there's another aspect of what exile is. Besides the harsh choice making that comes in the face of persecution, there's a gentler kind of choice making. Will I seek God when I don't have to? So at the beginning of the Babylonian exile, where they were experiencing persecution still, have a maniac ruling so drunk on self-worship that he wants everyone to bow before him as though he was God. Most people in fear gave in, some people didn't. But the lines were drawn clean. This is them and this is us. He is not me. But later, when things got comfortable, there was a different kind of a choice. Am I Babylonia in its comforts, in its security, or am I something else? So the fact is, there was a great deal of concealment, more when things were comfortable than when things were not. By concealment, I mean concealment of God's presence. He was hidden in the luxury of Babel. Babel was conquered. Okay, it was conquered by the Persians. The Persians were very, very different. The Persians had a culture that was known for its aesthetic, its refinement, its luxury. It's very appealing. But it had no morality, and we had to confront that. So the Babylonians were murderers. They were, as all military forces are, they conquered conquerors. The Persians, again, you know the story of the Megillah, Ahasuerus's horrific beauty contest, where women, whether they wanted to or not, whether they were married or not, were brought before him for him to decide who he wants. There was Gilearios there. All of the outpouring of beauty was tame, was defiled. And it took the Purim story for us to figure it out. That Gashmias is not the enemy, it's meant to be used. Think Mishloach Manos, think Matanos to Evyonim. But it's never a replacement for Hashem's will. Okay, the Persians allowed the Jews to go back. And we did go back to build the second temple. And it was a very noble effort, and it required a lot from everybody who was there. But the Persians were conquered, and the Greeks entered the scene. The Greeks were humanists and intellectuals. And their words and their ideas were very, very appealing. Okay, they weren't spiritual. They had their whole pantheon of gods, but they were very much in the background. They worshipped what? In Tehillim it says, Lo yabacha elzar, let there not be a foreign god in you. They worshipped humans. They said, we are the only beings that can give definition and purpose to ourselves and the world. If I think it's good, it's good. If I think it's bad, it's bad. If it gives me pleasure, it's good. If it doesn't give me pleasure, it's bad. It's all about me in my most limited state. So here we are, we're still in exile. And again, we could make tikkunim. The tikkun of the Greek mentality, of course, was the Hanukkah story. But we're not finished, because the Greeks were conquered by the Romans. So I'm going to take you all the way now to the end of the Second Temple period, and then I'll take you back to its beginnings. The end. The Romans are persecuting us with greater ferocity than any other people had before, as we saw in the Holocaust. And what were we facing when we faced the Romans? The Romans had three main philosophies. One was the philosophy of strength and overcoming, the Spartan philosophy. If you could overcome it, if you could lift that weight that weighs 300 pounds, if you could do that, then you're a valid human being. Their idea being that human strength deserves the front page. It's the center of reality. There was another perspective, academia. If you know, then you are. And again, the idea that human knowledge can conquer anything, can overcome anything, and should ultimately be worshipped, was very, very much part of their picture. You have hedonism. It feels good, if it tastes good, if it looks good, must be good, because it's all about me and my pleasures. So these three main ways of thought, hedonism, Spartacanism, and Hellenism, academia, all of them affected different parts of the way we think, which is our deep and most internal selves. So what makes a person is their body, their feelings, and their mind. That's what makes you you. Okay, so every person was somehow impacted by the Beis HaMikdash. You have the Aron, which is the head, the menorah, which is the heart, the digestive organs, which was the Mizbeach of Korbanot. We were addressing ourselves to Hashem. The Romans teach you how to take every one of these aspects of being and move them away from Hashem. The hedonists would say, you don't elevate food, you don't offer it on the altar, you don't say a bracha, you don't say Birkat HaMazon, you don't want to know about kashrus. It's all nonsense. It's all about eating. It's the voice of hedonism. Eat, drink, be merry, tomorrow you may die. Okay? There are other voices. You have the voice of academia saying, if you know you're empowered, if you know you could do it, knowledge is power. But the knowledge that they valued was external knowledge. What do I mean by external knowledge? The greatest scientist could describe something from the outside and do it well. They could talk to you about, let's say, the workings of a cell and do it well. But do they know the inner dimension of the cell, its purpose in being, the spiritual force that gives it life? No one has ever made life in the laboratory. They can't make even one cell, because life isn't just surface, and all academia knows is surface. So we have the head, we have the body, and between them, we have the heart. What captured our hearts? So what captured our hearts wasn't academia, certainly wasn't Spartan. What captured our hearts? So if you step back a little bit, and you say, well, what does capture our hearts, even today? Is it overcoming? Is it eating? No, it's saying, I have a goal and I can meet it. Look at ideologies that we've seen over the years, Christianity, communism. They start always, I believe that this can be. We could overcome evil. The yearning to overcome evil is where the emotions go in their most healthy state in Olam Hazeh. But when it's misused, it wreaks havoc. So the Romans destroyed our identity from the head to the heart to the body, and at the same time they destroyed the physical body of the temple. So let's go back. How was the Mikdash Sheni different than Mikdash Rishon? Mikdash Sheni was very different. Look at the circumstances. Mikdash Rishon was built after David HaMelech conquered Yerushalayim and then bought the field of Arnon HaYavusi, and began the process of building the Beis HaMikdash, completed by Shlomo, continual miracles, great light. And then you have something else. The Persian governor gives permission, a limited number of people come, they're continually in battle, the Samaritans are giving them a run for their money. And when the temple is finally built, it's not like it was before. No more miracles, no more answers from the Urim V'Tumim. Even the ark itself, the ark had been hidden. When they built the Beis HaMikdash, they built a special place to hide it. In the times of Yoshiyahu, it was hidden. So in the time of the Second Temple, the most dramatic moment of the year, when the Kohen Gadol pushes aside the curtains and goes into the Kodesh Kedoshim. Did he face the Aron? No, there was no Aron, just a stone on the floor. So what was the purpose of the second Beis HaMikdash? So I want you to hear this carefully because it's very relevant to our lives. It's more noble to seek Hashem when he's hidden than it is to find him when he's revealed. That's what the second Beis HaMikdash was about. Hashem was saying, I'm letting you come back. It's a Beis HaMikdash. My presence is here. The Evan Shetiyah is drawing you. But I'm not giving this to you. You have to earn it. You have to strive for it. You have to yearn. And then it'll be yours. And the connection will be more real. And the second Beis HaMikdash was lost because we hate each other. Senselessly. So what does senseless hatred really mean? Nobody ever admits to hating someone senselessly. It means not saying the Elokut in the other person. And this goes back to what we said at the beginning. That Hashem is in everything. He's the overwhelmingly united power, and his manifestation is in the Jewish people, even in the heart of every individual Jew, not just the noblemen amongst us. So when you're asking yourself what to mourn about on the Korban, even though I admitted it's hard to relate to the Beis HaMikdash because we are the third generation from the girl who was captured, I want you to think about what's wrong with yourself and wrong with the world. All these things are consequences of exile. Exile is all a consequence of the destruction of the temple. The destruction of the temple begins inside with our identity. So use this day to rediscover your identity, to figure out who you are as the descendant of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And may Hashem grant it that this be our last Tisha B'Av of mourning, that subsequent ones will be of joy.